Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. For some 40 years, Spain was ruled by the dictator Francisco Franco. Spaniards were imprisoned, disappeared, killed, and buried in mass graves. Some were also separated from their infant children. In 1977, after the establishment of democratic rule, the Spanish Parliament passed an amnesty law that activists had pushed for to win amnesty for political prisoners. But that law also granted amnesty to the perpetrators of crimes on behalf of the dictatorship. It came to be known as the Pact of Forgetting. Schools in Spain do not teach young people about what happened under Franco, and parents don't tell their children, who cannot pass down recollections of what happened, because they don't know. But some victims have tried to bring war criminals to justice for crimes against humanity. In the new documentary, The Silence of Others, we meet some of these survivors. In addition to hearing their stories, we also watch them file an international lawsuit for justice. And today we are joined by the film's co-director. Robert Behar is an Emmy-winning documentary filmmaker, producer, and writer. He has dedicated more than a decade to documentary education through DocuLink, a community of 4,000 documentarians that he co-founded and directed for 10 years. The Silence of Others is currently playing in theaters across the country. You can find showtimes at thesilenceofothers.com. You can also watch the trailer at yourcallradio.org, and The Silence of Others will air on PBS's Point of View on September 30th. And The Silence of Others co-director Robert Behar joins us in studio. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much. This film was just so fascinating to watch, and there are so many parallels that we can talk about later in the program. So you co-directed this film with your wife, Almudena Caracedo, and this is very personal for her because she's actually narrating the documentary.
So Almudena is narrating the film, and Almudena is Spanish, and I'm from the United States, and we met in Los Angeles, and we made a film there. And I think in Almudena's mind, there'd always been this feeling that here she was dealing with human rights issues in other parts of the world, but that there was something pending at home. And I remember, and at some point we moved to New York, and I remember getting home one day and Almudena was crying. And I said, what's going on? And it was the year 2010, and these Spanish newspapers had just started to break the story of the stolen children in Spain. And at the time, we had actually had our daughter right around the same time. And so this was very personal to us as young parents. And she'd always had that desire to track these shadows of the Franco dictatorship and the situation for victims and survivors of these crimes. And when that happened, we started researching and set out to make a film that would explore that. And initially, we thought that perhaps the film would just focus on these cases of stolen children. And as we, when we got back to Spain and started researching, we realized that there was this bigger effort. There was this, it's called the Argentine lawsuit that was starting to unfold that included not just cases of stolen children, but families who are fighting to get their loved ones' bodies out of mass graves, victims of torture from the 60s and the 70s, and many other crimes that had taken place.
What's so interesting about this is I am assuming and guessing here that when people think of Spain, they think of Barcelona. I've been there. It's an amazing city. The Gothic Quarter is just incredible. They think of Antoni Gaudi and that incredible architecture. But this just happened very recently. Do you think, I mean, based on all the research you've done, I mean, you even interviewed people, young people in Spain who don't know about this recent history. What about the wider population?
So I admit I was one of those people who in school had studied the Spanish Civil War. I learned about Franco coming to power, and then you kind of get to World War II. And I myself, I feel ignorant that I didn't even realize there had been this 40-year dictatorship. And these things collide so much. So the building in the center of Madrid, where they celebrate New Year's Eve, the building with the clock that counts down to midnight, is the building where people were tortured in the 1960s and the 70s. And one of the characters on our film, Chato Galante, actually remembers being in the basement of that building in a jail cell and hearing the sound of New Year's Eve up above. And that image is such a contrast to me because that is what protects impunity. And so in Spain, you're right, there's a scene in the film where we talk to some young people in that same central square, and we ask them, have you heard of the amnesty law? No, no, we're not sure. Kind of rings a bell, but no. And so this pact of forgetting was very effective.
And then you talk to older people who say that's the past. Let's not even go there. Okay, so for those of us who are not very familiar with Franco and the dictatorship, just remind us what exactly happened under that 40-year rule and why was his regime so incredibly brutal?
So Franco led a military rebellion that kind of set off the Spanish Civil War. During the Spanish Civil War, you know, there were crimes that did happen on both sides, but behind the lines, there was terrible repression coming from Franco's troops. There were thousands and thousands of civilians who were killed during the conflict. After Franco won the Spanish Civil War and became the dictator, there continued to be repression of people who were suspected to be leftists, of teachers, of, you know, many different people were targeted and often were labeled as being Reds. As the decades unfolded, we see this change. There's political repression, but there's also this moral repression that takes place. And the right to public assembly, the right to a free press wasn't possible. In Catalonia, you couldn't speak Catalan. That was illegal. In the Basque country, they could not speak their language. And so through this whole period, there is a lot of repression. And a lot of people don't know about it because it was kind of happening around the edges or was happening to poor families. Or there's sort of this expression, well, if you didn't go looking for trouble, you didn't get into trouble.
So the left fought after Franco died. He was still in power when he died.
Yes.
And his regime had a lot of power and control in the process of shaping democracy. This is also very interesting because when we covered Spain's election a couple of weeks ago, I was reading about how this is a new democracy. And I think that is even news to some people, a relatively new democracy. So talk about that transition after Franco died.
So Spain's transition from dictatorship to democracy for a while was held up as an international model because what it did achieve was a peaceful transition of power from the Franco regime to the democracy, to creating a democracy. But when a regime leaves, but they still are in power, they have this ability to shape what the democracy will look like. And one of the things that happened was this amnesty law that was passed. And so, yes, as you said earlier, you had activists who were fighting for an amnesty to get political prisoners out. But you also had something added to the amnesty law that would prevent the investigation or prosecution of the crimes of the dictatorship. But there's something else that happened. Because it was this kind of transition, there were all of these continuities that took place. So in the judiciary in Spain, many of the same judges just continued, and to this day, you might have some of the same judges, or it might be the same families that continue to be judges. And in the security forces, whether it's the military or various police forces, there are those continuities. And so there was never a clean break with the past of the dictatorship. And there's this scene that a lot of people are kind of struck by in the film where in Spain there's a foundation called the Francisco Franco Foundation. Mm-hmm. Imagine if in Germany there was an Adolf Hitler Foundation. But here there's a Franco Foundation. The spokesman of that foundation describes how he thinks many of the politicians should boldly proclaim their roots in the Franco dictatorship. So on the left, people are pointing out that these politicians have roots in the dictatorship. And then on the very far right, they're agreeing that they have those roots, but arguing that they should express their pride in that.
Well, and so you're talking about Alonso, is it?
Jaime Alonso.
Jaime Alonso.
Yes.
And he says that politicians favor forgetting because remembering or investigating the past would mean looking into their own past and their participation in the dictatorship systems. He also says that the most important thing to remember about Franco is that he was never wrong. He saved Christian Western civilization from communist tyranny. And then you have this video in there of U.S. politicians, including Richard Nixon and Dwight D. Eisenhower, embracing Franco in the fight against communism.
And right after World War II, for a little while, the Franco dictatorship was kind of ostracized because of its association with Hitler and Mussolini. But the quote that you just read just pinpoints it. As the 20th century switched to focusing on the Cold War, Franco became one of those dictators that the U.S. and other Western powers would come to embrace, come to see as one of our necessary friends. The United States built and still maintains military bases in Spain. And a lot of the 20th century history has stories like that.
Hmm. What else struck you about your conversation with Jaime Alonso from the Franco Foundation? Did you even know that this existed?
You know, everyone kind of knows that it exists. Hmm. And they're very open to giving interviews. They know that a lot of the people who come there probably will not be in full agreement with them. I think what struck me is just how some of the discourse that Franco was able to create over 40 years remains today. And of course, there you see it in a very radical form. But in that other scene where you see older people saying, we just have to put this aside, nothing good will come of talking to this, all of that discourse comes from the dictatorship.
I was also struck by the footage you have of a rally of right-wingers who are holding signs, make Spain great again.
Yes.
How widespread is that in Spain? And what do these people actually stand for?
So that rally was on the anniversary of Franco's death. So that, until recently, we thought was a very narrow fringe, that nostalgia for the dictatorship, which I must say mirrors the kind of nostalgia that some politicians like Trump might draw upon to say there were these better times, right? But what we've seen in Spain is that there has suddenly been a rise of the far right, not exactly connected to that nostalgia for Franco, but just the way you've seen ultra-right parties rise around Europe and around the world. There is now a new party called Vox, which in the April 28th election got 9 to 10% of the vote. And so for the first time since the Franco dictatorship, there will be multiple representatives in parliament from an ultra-right, ultra-nationalist, anti-abortion, anti-laws that protect women from gender violence party.
Well, today we're speaking with Robert Behar. He's co-director of the new documentary, The Silence of Others. It tells the stories of victims under Spain's dictatorship, under General Franco, and their search for justice. It's an incredible film. There are so many parallels to, well, war crimes in many, many countries, and we'll talk about that a little later in the show. It is now playing in theaters. You can watch the trailer at yourcallradio.org, and it'll air on PBS on September 30th. And if you have any questions for Robert, we'd love to hear from you. I think that one of the very interesting questions that this film asks that I think about when I think about wars committed by the United States is, what does justice look like when crimes are committed by the state? So what questions and thoughts do you have about this? If you are from Spain, if you've lived there, have connections, what do you remember about Franco's dictatorship? And what are your thoughts about this law? The left fought for amnesty to free political prisoners, and out of that came the Pact to Forget. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's talk about this Pact of Forgetting, because it's just, it's a while to wrap your head around this. And you have a politician in your film who said, quote, "A forgetting for all by all. It is the only way we can shake hands without rancor," end quote. Just such a simplistic way of putting it. Leave it in the past and move on. So talk about this pact to forget.
So there was really this idea that, and all perpetrators often proposed this, but there was really this idea that we just have to turn the page. There's no way we can deal with that past. We're just going to turn the page and look forward. And using simplistic metaphors, what some of the activists will say is, well, you can't turn the page without reading it. And so in this idea of transitional justice, some people say, okay, what we're doing is we're exchanging justice for peace. That is what's being traded off. I've had people ask me that, and my response is always, well, was peace achieved? If you have thousands of mass graves still today containing 114,000 bodies that have yet to be exhumed, if you have torturers walking on the street, if you have mothers searching for babies who were stolen, was peace achieved? And so if you look at other countries, how they've handled this, it's always imperfect. But there was the truth and reconciliation model in South Africa. In other countries, there have been truth commissions and some attempt at national reconciliation. Sometimes there have been United Nations special tribunals. But this idea of just locking it all up and leaving it behind is no longer thought to be effective because it has all of these consequences.
You have footage in the film when the Pact to Forget passed. It looked like the entire room of politicians stood and clapped. Were there any politicians that opposed this and pushed back?
Actually, in that vote, I think there are two votes against, or either two votes against or two abstentions. But actually, they were people who didn't want the political prisoners freed. And so it was very universal. I know there were people with differing views at that time. But what people tell us, including Almudena's parents, is that if you grew up your entire life under the dictatorship, it was hard to contemplate that another way was possible. And there was this military saber rattling. There was this fear that the military might do something. And so we don't want to judge what was possible in that moment. We really do want to ask, how, during 40 years of democracy, can that never have been addressed? How can anyone think that Maria Martin should forget the search for her mother's body?
Tell us about Maria Martin. The film opens with her. She's an elder woman. She was amazing. I mean, at first I thought she was whispering, right. But this is just how she talks, right? Her mother was buried in a mass grave, and she's right there. We see it. It's been paved over. And as the cars zoom by, she's just staring at the road, knowing that her mother's buried there. And thousands of people go to the sides of these roads to put flowers down for their loved ones.
So there are thousands of mass graves around Spain. Maria Martin, actually her father used to take flowers to that grave and tie them to the guardrail, once there was a guardrail, the way she does. And she took up that tradition. Maria Martin wrote to the king. She wrote to the prime minister. She wrote to court. She wrote to the mayor, asking everyone if they would help her get her mother's remains so she could bury them. And this is just a basic human need, to bury one's loved ones with dignity.
Today we're speaking with Robert Behar, co-director of the new documentary The Silence of Others, which tells the stories of victims of Spain's dictatorship under General Franco and their search for justice. It's out in theaters now, and I hope you can see it. You can watch the trailer at our website, yourcallradio.org. It'll air on PBS on September 30th. And let's hear from a listener. Let's go to Sally in Oakland. Hi, Sally. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you, Rose. I was wondering the documentarian, how does the history of Francoism influence the reaction by the Spanish government to Catalan independence? They've beat voters in October. They banned the color yellow. They put all their leaders into preventative prison. So how is that legacy sort of guiding what's happening now today in the Barcelona, Catalan area?
So I'm not an expert on the situation with Catalonia and the movement for independence right now, but there are a couple of important points to make. One thing is that on October 1st, when there was the vote that was going to take place in Catalonia, I think almost universally, when people saw that repression, when people saw people being grabbed by their legs and dragged out of schools where they were just trying to vote, wherever you stand in terms of that question, it was clear that this was powerful repression coming from Madrid, coming from the center. And so I think it echoed that for many, many people. And people remembered that the Catalan language was forbidden under Franco. It was illegal to speak Catalan under Franco. The other interesting thing is that just the way the Pact of Forgetting was forged in the transition, these agreements to allow autonomy for certain regions and ultimately for all of the autonomous communities in Spain, those were also things that were forged during Spain's transition to democracy. And so here we are 40 years later, and you can see there are many things related to the transition that are coming open again, maybe as a new generation confronts those decisions, and they're being revisited.
Mm. How do the leftist parties today, what do they think about the Pact of Forgetting? I mean, are there movements to include this information in schools so young people learn about it?
So there are many movements, I'd say, on the real left, for example, a party like Podemos. Mm-hmm. I mean, you really do see a huge interest in supporting the victims, in seeking justice, that Billy the Kid, you know, one of the torturers, should be put to justice, go to court. And so there's all of that. And the government that's in power right now, Pedro Sanchez, the PSOE, the Socialist Party, from about a year ago, they've actually been trying to take Franco's body out of this giant mausoleum that it's in called the Valley of the Fallen. And so there are these initiatives, but there are also these limits. And so a year or two ago, there was a vote in the parliament to modify Spain's amnesty law so that it could not be applied to crimes against humanity.
Wow.
That would have been a tremendous help in terms of these cases. And many of the parties on the left voted to support that. But actually, the Socialist Party, which is also one of the parties on the left, did not vote to support that. And if they had, it could have passed. And so even within that broader left, there's still work to be done about how much justice can be achieved. And that's part of the purpose of the lawsuit that you see unfold in the film.
And before we go to break, what was their reasoning for voting no? When you say that there's still disagreement on the left, what is that disagreement?
I think part of it goes back to the idea that that Pact of Forgetting is such a foundation to the society that things could be torn apart, you know, which I think a lot of people wouldn't agree that it's going to tear things apart. It's actually going to help victims and survivors. But I think that's out there. And of course, this touches power. Where did those stolen babies go? Who are those former cabinet ministers who are being investigated? What power do they or their families have today?
And what does justice actually look like?
Right, right.
Today, we're speaking with Robert Behar, an Emmy-winning documentary filmmaker, producer, and writer. He is co-director of the new documentary, The Silence of Others. It's an incredible documentary telling the stories of victims of Spain's dictatorship under Franco and their search for justice. It's playing in theaters now across the country, and it'll air on PBS on September 30th. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will hear from activists who have just concluded a bus tour of California to end child poverty across the state. Nearly 2 million children in California live in poverty. That is 1 in 5 kids. So we will talk about what it will take to actually address this crisis. Today, we are speaking with Robert Behar. He is co-director of The Silence of Others. It's a new documentary that tells the stories of victims of Spain's dictatorship under Franco and their search for justice. The film follows survivors for 6 years in their struggle to ensure that Spain actually faces its past, and they're also organizing a groundbreaking lawsuit that sought trials for crimes against humanity. And if you have any questions or comments for Robert, we would love to hear from you. One of the big questions the story asks, or the documentary asks, is what does justice look like when crimes are committed by the state? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's talk about some of the people we meet in the film. We meet, is it Chato?
Yes.
So this is Jose Galante. And this man was amazing, and you spent a lot of time with him. He was showing you the apartment building where Antonio Gonzalez Pacheco lives. His nickname is Billy the Kid. Now, Chato says Billy the Kid tortured him 3 times when he was just over 20. He said, quote, "I live just meters away from the person who tortured me," end quote. Chato says that he's got a lot of information about Billy the Kid. For example, he ran the 33rd Marathon in Madrid and ran a marathon in New York. So how common is it for people today to live next to people who tortured them or possibly killed their loved ones?
Well, it is common because nothing has ever been done about people who were suspected of torture. In terms of, you know, he's known as Billy the Kid, as you said. Even from the late 70s and early 80s, there were articles in newspapers where people knew that he was notorious. You know, there were many people who did engage in torture in that they call it the social political brigade of the police. But he, for his sort of sadistic approach, became kind of legendary among activists and students at that time. And so we went with Chato, and Chato said, "Let's take a walk." And we left Chato's house, and we took a few minutes, and we arrived at this house in the same neighborhood where Antonio Gonzalez Pacheco, Billy the Kid, lives. And in every region had its own Billy the Kid. You know, there was this kind of repression happening across Spain.
Chato also lives on a street named after a general who had 4,000 political prisoners executed. And he says, every day I wake up on a street dedicated to this war criminal.
Chato lives, or lived, because there's actually some good news about that part of the story, but he lived on a street named after this general called General Yahweh, who was actually known as the butcher of Badajoz, of the city of Badajoz, for killing nearly 4,000 people after conquering the city, coming up, moving northwards into Spain. And the idea that there could be street names commemorating generals who perpetrated such violence is shocking. So imagine if you're a victim of torture that took place in the 70s, living on a street dedicated to a general who did these terrible things, you know, during the Spanish Civil War. And there's another street that's named after Antonio Bayona-Jara, the psychiatrist who planted the foundations for the stolen children. And it gets to this question that actually touches something that's happening in the United States as well. So there's a scene in the film where you have members of the same family talking about, should we have these streets? And one person makes a point, which you hear a lot, which is, well, this is our history, good or bad, it's our history. And the point that actually his sister makes is, well, it's our history. We should remember our history. It should be in our history books. But if we have a street name or a statue of someone looking grandly on a horse, right, we're not just recording and remembering history. We're celebrating that history. We're telling our children we are honoring this person with a street or with a statue, and these are role models for you. And that difference is very important in the case of Spain, and I actually think it's also part of the discussion about Confederate monuments here in the United States.
Yes. That's what I was thinking. There's so many parallels.
Yes,
the Confederate monuments in the United States, as well as street names of people who committed genocide against Native Americans.
Yes.
Statues of the same thing. I mean, people are fighting that. We just had a statue taken down right in San Francisco, downtown.
What statue was that?
Well, it was basically these Catholics kind of overlooking, literally looking on top of a native man who was laying down.
Wow.
With no context. That's the problem with some of these statues. There's no context. There's just a little plaque, no history. I mean, it would be one thing if, along with that statue, there was a plaque that said, by the way, the Ohlone people are the first peoples here. This many people were killed in the Bay Area or California, but that doesn't, it just doesn't exist.
And that's what's so fascinating. And I think that's where societies have that job, I like the word you use, to contextualize.
Right.
And part of what art and film can do is to provide some of that context. And if history has been erased in the little way that artists can contribute to social movements, you can try and fill some of that context back in.
Mm. I want to ask you more about more parallels before we end.
Yes.
But I want to get back to Chato.
Yes.
Just to let people know who he is, who he was. In 1968, he joined the Democratic Student Union, and he said there was no freedom of press, no rights of assembly. And a member of that union, Enrique Rano,
yes,
was murdered by the police. They put two shots in his head and threw him out a window, calling it suicide. And Chato said this was just really, really intense. Quote, "This makes a deep impression. That's when I decided I had no choice but to devote my life to ending that dictatorship," end quote. So that was his experience in the late 60s. And here he is today walking you by the man who tortured him, who lives across the street.
And one thing Chato has said to us is, he said, "I never imagined that 40 years later I would still be fighting for justice against Billy the Kid or against members from the regime."
What does justice look like to someone like Chato?
So this is a fascinating question, because for each person involved, justice means something different. Mm. So Chato is really looking for a judicial kind of justice. The perpetrator, Billy the Kid, and the many parallel people are still out there. They're healthy. They're in their early 70s at this point. He thinks that Billy the Kid should be put on trial for the systematic torture and repression of people who were active during those late years of the Franco dictatorship. He is looking for that kind of justice. And there's a moment in the film where Chato says, "Some people say I'm looking for revenge." Mm. Chato says, "You can only say that if you think that looking for justice is looking for revenge. I'm not looking for revenge. I should have the same right to justice that anyone else would who had been tortured in this way."
It's also so interesting when you think about the legalities around this, because another person we meet is Carlos Slepoy, one,
yes,
of the human rights lawyers who helped bring the case in Argentina. And I don't want to give too much away about him and what happens, but he talks in the film about how it seems obvious that when someone is murdered, we should prosecute the murderer and provide reparations to the victim. Yet when we talk about genocide or crimes against humanity, it's not so clear. There's a tendency to make excuses. "It was a long time ago. Forget that. We have to turn the page." I mean, you hear this a lot when we bring up history in this country to certain people. They say, "That was the past. It's time to move on."
You hear that so much. And the idea of turning the page, Chato would say, you can't turn the page without reading the page. You have to know what happened. And if you look around the world, that idea that you can just leave things behind, mm, really doesn't work. What's the consequence? The consequence is that a group of people who were being persecuted end up being marginalized and made invisible. But we often hear this: if one person is killed, it's a tragedy. If 10 million are killed, it's a statistic.
Right. I could not help but think about the crimes committed by this country. We're talking about immigration right now. Look at all of the U.S. intervention in Central America. Look at what's happening in the Middle East, the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan. What does justice mean for Iraqis, for Afghans, for people in Yemen? I'm wondering, in 30 years, are we finally going to perhaps be able to pursue crimes against humanity for crimes committed? I mean, after going through this process, given that you are from here, but you now live in Spain, right. What are your thoughts on that? What came up for you?
Well, I think, I mean, it's beautiful that you were just talking about Carlos Lepuy. I mean, what Carlos believed was that there have to be more mechanisms of international justice because we keep seeing states commit crimes against their own people or commit crimes elsewhere with impunity. And his idea was that the principle of universal jurisdiction could help a lot in terms of providing venues all over the world. The idea is that if crimes against humanity cannot be prosecuted where they took place, judges in other countries can investigate them. In terms of the sort of more personal question that you're asking me as an American, I'm deeply troubled when the division of parents from their children at the border, if these are not atrocities or crimes against humanity that someday need to be adjudicated, I don't know what are.
Today we're speaking with Robert Behar, co-director of the documentary The Silence of Others. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. This film tells the stories of victims of Spain's dictatorship under Franco and their long search for justice. It's in theaters now, and it'll air on PBS on September 30th. And let's hear from Carlos in San Francisco, who has a very personal story to share. Hi, Carlos. Welcome to the show.
Hi. My name is Carlos Guevara, and I grew up, I was born outside Spain on my father's exile from Franco. But I grew up in Granada in southern Spain. What I want to talk about is the fact that we put justice on a small criminal that steals a loaf of bread. Then we let someone like the general of the Guardia Civil in Granada, who used to sign execution orders by the family. And I understand that there were crimes on both sides. But this general, when he was a captain before the war, somebody sent him a bomb that was a letter. When he opened it, it took one of his eyes out and his hand. So after that, he was out for revenge. That's why he signed. This is humanity at its worst. But we cannot let that go, you see. This general, for example, one of my friends, his father was wealthy, had ranches. And the general put his older brother, my friend's older brother, in jail. They were going to execute him. So when the father went to the general to plead for his life, the general said, well, I want to buy this ranch from you. It's one of the best ranches in the province of Granada. And my friend's father said, yeah, sure, I'll sell it to you. How much? And he offered him the price of a bull, which was nothing. So he had to sign away the ranch in the name of the general. Now this general gets to keep the ranch, keep the wealth, and never ever be accounted for all these families that he executed. I don't see how that can happen. You see, if we're going to ask for justice, then it should be for all.
Well, thank you for calling in, Carlos. Thank you for sharing your story.
Right. Okay, bye.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Carlos. That's a very powerful story, and there are stories from across Spain like that. And I think it's important that the point that Carlos mentioned, that there were crimes that happened on, quote-unquote, both sides, is very important to acknowledge, but it's also important to acknowledge that anyone who did something against Franco's military rebellion, anyone who did something against the regime, was quickly prosecuted and punished. And Franco and the nationalist side had the opportunity to bury their dead. And so sometimes people in Spain try to use the argument, well, there were things that happened on both sides. We just need to forget about it. Because it kind of all, there's no way you can figure all that again. But if you look at the difference in scale, and if you look at the systematic nature of what Franco and his troops and then his regime did, and if you look at everything that happened during the dictatorship, there's so much that reflects this great impunity, which I think actually Carlos is what Carlos was addressing in terms of you steal a loaf of bread and you'll be punished, but look at this tremendous power and impunity. Mm.
I can't help but think about this law and order, which is what we're hearing from this administration right now.
Often in countries where you see dictators being tolerated, one of the arguments that gets used is, well, it was a tough time and we needed a tough leader. And I think that is always the road to abuses and is always people being taken away.
Mm. Well, thanks again, Carlos. Let's go next to Donald in Oakland. Hi, Donald. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Rose. About a month ago, Easter Sunday, my lady friend and I were in Barcelona, and we wandered around the old Gothic quarter, and right alongside the Gothic cathedral, we turned the corner, and there was a very graphic protest, a silent protest, a vigil almost, with photographs of the people who, some people who've been murdered or tortured under Franco's regime, and the men who were standing there alongside their banners were quite happy to tell people what brutality Franco visited on the folks, the Catalans in the Barcelona area. You could look at the faces and you could see from the observers, people looking, especially younger people, I think were astonished to think that in their own country there was such mass repression and brutal repression at that. And it was very effective. It was certainly effective for us to see. And that kind of thing is important for people to have as a reminder. I mean, whatever the solution would be, a reconciliation in Spain, it's important for people to know their past. And those brave men who did that were, I think, offering a big service to Spaniards.
Hmm. Yeah, thank you, Donald. There's some footage in the documentary, The Silence of Others, of exactly what you're describing.
So there are protests, there are manifestaciones to try to get the word out. And, you know, what Donald just described in Barcelona sounds like a powerful example of that. Mm-hmm. There's footage in the film. There's a group in Madrid that every Thursday night for years, they have been doing a protest outside that building, the General Security Headquarters, where people were tortured, trying to let the tourists who are there know, trying to let young people know what happened and that nothing has ever been done about it.
Thank you, Donald. Let's hear next from Michael in Berkeley. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for taking my call. I know up against the clock. Two questions. The role of the Catholic Church. We know they backed Franco to the hilt. Currently, what's going on, especially with Opus Dei in charge of the Church? Any good information on this? Secondly, the right in this country, every time, and who knows who the right is, the Democrats aren't, it's one party with two right wings. But anyway, when the right really gets in there, they go into the Library of Congress and they loot valuable information that reflects poorly on the right, for instance, the Vietnam War. Any institution like that in Spain, and is it being looted or are documents being disappeared that would again lend truth to that era?
Well, in terms of the role of the Catholic Church, the film touches on it a little bit, but some of the pillars of the Franco dictatorship, on the one hand, you had the Fascist Party, the military, and the Catholic Church. And we allude to it a little bit, especially in the stolen children cases, where you hear priests and nuns were involved in those cases and were working in hospitals. And so it comes up in that way. But you're right that that was part of how this dictatorship worked. In terms of the question of libraries and archives and things like that, one of the things that they're actually trying to do in this activism is get more archives opened up. And if I'm not mistaken, I think that Judge Cervini, the judge in Argentina who's investigating this case, has even sent records requests to the Vatican to see if there's information about what took place in Spain, in part related to the stolen children cases.
And since we're talking about archives and the importance of exposing this information. I want to make sure I ask you before we end. We have full lines, actually. There's so much interest in this film and this topic, which is fantastic. So I want to get back to the calls. But before we end, this film has been shown in Spain.
Yes.
What has the reaction been?
So when we first started making this, we weren't sure if this would ever be shown in Spain.
Really?
We didn't know.
Wow.
It's
today,
hard to
even
talk about this.
Wow.
But we knew, I mean, there are many books about this. There have been other films, but they tend to kind of stay within the movement. They don't have that wider footprint. And so we thought we would start outside Spain to try and build up momentum before we arrived. The film premiered in Berlin, and Spanish journalists would report back on it. We had 9 months building up to the arrival in Spain. We got theatrical distribution in Spain. It opened about 20 cities. And the press from the left to the right was very positive about the film. A right-wing newspaper actually even titled an article, "Should We Forget the Pact of Forgetting?" So that was something we could see it was working. In February, the film won the Goya, which is Spain's Oscar. When we accepted the Goya, 6 of the protagonists were on stage with us, including Chato and including Maria Angeles, Maria Martin's daughter. But we knew our biggest impact would be if we could get the film on public television in Spain. And after the film was nominated for the Goya, we got an offer to air it. That was on April 4th. And we had a little communications team sitting at our dining room table. And we put out these little posters, and people would put posters up in their neighborhood. 2 hours before the broadcast, the Prime Minister of Spain tweeted that tonight is a moment when everyone should reflect upon memory and watch this film.
Wow.
That day, our Facebook posts were reaching 700,000 people. They were being shared 19,000 times. And so ultimately, 1.2 million people watched the broadcast that night. The film was the number 2 trending topic on Twitter in all of Spain. And as the film started to come down from being trending topic, there was another topic coming up. And that topic was 1977 amnesty law. So if you think about that, this pact of forgetting, a film is helping bring that back into the discourse. And that was part of our mission, and there's lots more to do. But in those ways, you can see the film really is making an impact where it's needed.
That is amazing. Did you ever expect this?
We never imagined the Prime Minister would tweet
wow.
about the film. It's what you hope for, but you know it's hard.
Incredible. Well, I want to get to as many calls as we can before we end. Let's hear from PJ in Santa Cruz. Hi, PJ.
Hi, I'm calling from California, but I grew up in Spain. My father went to the Blue Division in Russian front, and some of the crazies he went with, they joined the SS, and the bodies that they made over there, Germans, they were refuge after in Spain, given Spanish names. And I went to school with the children of them. And this is outrageous that, you know, Eichmann was taken by the Israelis to be judged, and those crimes should never prescribe. I don't know why in Spain they live in a limbo that they make believe, and I'm sorry for just being upset about it.
No, please, you don't apologize. I mean, and it's
just outrageous.
Yes.
I know it's true, all these things.
Can I ask you, PJ, what does justice look like for you?
Justice? If there is no justice, it cannot be looked any way, positive or negative. They're pretending there is no justice.
Mm.
So make believe thing they have in the justice system in Spain.
And PJ, you're talking in part about the Blue Division, which was actually a volunteer division of soldiers
in Russia, Franco.
Right, that came from Spain and that were helping the Nazis on the Russian front. Correct me if I'm wrong, PJ.
Yes, and my father was in the ring around Stalingrad, and some of his friends crossed the division and joined the SS. They were just with the Nazis, and they made bodies there that they brought to Spain, and somehow they got them legal papers about their identities. And I grew up with the children of some of these Germans.
And up until at least very recently in Madrid, there was a street named after the fallen of the Blue Division. So you have a street name honoring a volunteer division that went to help support the Nazis.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for calling in, PJ. We're out of time. We have a number of callers. Dave in Berkeley says, are there similar attempts to investigate perpetrators of Indian genocide in California? Greg says, in Palo Alto, we don't even acknowledge the crimes of slavery or Indian genocide. Kathleen says, the United States refuses to come under the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court.
These are these great questions about international justice and about how those with power also need watchdogs. In fact, we're seeing this play out today with who's going to testify in front of Congress. You know, those in power also need watchdogs and cannot be above justice. Mm.
Well, you know, I was thinking that we would rebroadcast the show when your film is out on PBS, but I instead would love to have you back.
Oh, how wonderful.
Because
thank
there's
you.
Just there's so much interest, and I think this question, what does justice look like when crimes are committed by the state,
yes,
applies to so many countries, very much in this country. So I'd love to continue that conversation, and maybe your wife can join us.
I look forward to it, and I think she may be here as well then.
That would be great. Again, your wife, Almudena Caracedo, she's co-director of this film and the narrator, and this is very personal for her. Robert Behar is co-director of The Silence of Others, and it's currently playing in theaters. It'll be on PBS on September 30th. We will definitely have Robert and hopefully his wife, Almudena, back on the show. It's a documentary that tells the stories of victims of Spain's dictatorship under Franco and their search for justice. Robert, congratulations. Really incredible, and thank you for coming in today.
Thank you so much. It's just wonderful to be here.
Thank you. And thank you for all of your calls and emails. I'm sorry we didn't get to all of them, but we will definitely revisit this conversation. Coming up tomorrow, we will hear from activists who have just concluded a bus tour of California to end child poverty across the state. Nearly 2 million children in California live in poverty. That is 1 in 5 kids. Advocates are touring the state by bus to raise support for a plan to end deep child poverty. We will talk about that tomorrow. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. You can find more information about the show, podcast the show, or listen to past shows, yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.